growing, you know, the classification system of development, assessment tools, which are the HGM guidebook. And these are, and I've got another presentation, but there's a lot of paths through the hard copy around, but they're, we've got a whole set of terms that sprung up within HGM, and I think we have these on, the handout, so I sent to Dr. Gray, so I'm not gonna spend much time to look at these, but they're not really that important unless you're talking with someone or working with someone, they specifically with HGM, but, you know, basically, we were talking about the area, the sampling weapon, reference weapon, all of the weapons that you look at, good, bad, or different condition. The ones that really receive a lot of attention are called reference standard weapons, and these are generally the ones that have not been, degraded to any significant extent, as far as they report anywhere, commits out the time, a truly pristine system. You can go into the happy river bottoms, and there's a nice block of course, and happy, so it's great. But, and it, you know, it's our reference standard weapon that does our look, but we don't really, you know, find places to fully have pretty low levels of engineering talent and other factors to some extent. But, you know, they're the ones that are gonna be important, because we're gonna compare others to the reference standard. And they also serve as good models for restoration. You know, you never run an assessment model if you wanna do a restoration project, you'll find a nice weapon, you can look at it and try to mimic the characteristics of it as much as you could. The models that we use in the assessment tools produce what we call a proximal capacity, and that's just a score from 1 to 10, which takes it to one more level, proximal capacity index, a score from 1 to 10, that indicates the capacity to which the weapon performs the problem. So, you guys ever have a lot of studies with HSI modeling, depth studies, or is there a couple of classes? Temp was an assessment tool that was developed in the 80s for the technology service. It's a set of models for individual species. For example, there's a model for bobwhite, the American woodcock, the woodduck, the turkey, the grouse, the deer, squirrel. And so it allows you to go into an area, if you've got a management area, you can measure the characteristics that are requested in the model and generate a score from 1 to 10. And so when we begin to work on the HGM classification model, we kind of patterned it after HEMP because a lot of the agencies were already using HEMP and had been relied on HEMP. It was a nice, well thought out format. I think everybody generally liked it. I can't think of a better way to do it, and so it was like, you know, well, we won't be in that wheel, we kind of build on what HEMP is. And so we go into a weapon and we get a score that's 0 to 1, so if we go and measure all the things that I'll show you in a little bit, and we do the calculations, and so we get a score of 0.8 for a certain function that goes out for that function that weapon is performing it at a pretty high level. And then, sort of the way the agency would use it, they would say, okay, your 0.8 weapon for that function was 10 acres in size, and so I have 8 functional capacity units. And so this is where the science kind of gets diluted, just sort of in terms of the practical nature of using HEMP as a tool to develop mitigation requirements. And that same bit of problem occurs with HEMP studies as well, but at any rate, it's probably best we can do it now. So, the first thing before you develop these guidebooks that are going around is we have to do what we call develop a functional profile of the weapon. And essentially, we go out into the world and we measure everything in the world and characterize the weapon as completely as we can. All of these factors that are sort of part of the classification system itself, but then we'll start going further to sort out. Now we're getting into, you know, what are the plant animals we use to occur in this type of weapon or that type of weapon. And then we want to look at the range of conditions, the very best all the way to the worst, and then what is the typical type of disturbance. And so we're just essentially, you know, finding out everything we can about the weapon. And the guidebook profile of each of these particular faculty members, so there is good academic courses in that place. I'm going to show you an example of a project that I worked on with my supervisor down in Southern Mississippi, Alabama. And we were developing the guidebook for the Headwaters float weapon. It was kind of like that little system that I showed you a minute ago about mapping here. But it's this community, it's this is, you know, above the headwaters, and then this is the slope level where water is discharging down slope. And it might be wet all up through here, but at some point, the channel will eventually form, it'll be the first water stream. And then eventually you'll get down to where you get other streams coming in, and the system will change from being groundwater discharge driven to overflow driven. Up here, the system that we refined the model is that the weapon itself influences the channel different even if there is a channel. It is in that part of the world, they're called bakes. Bake all various types of swaths, what's called steep heads and places. Kind of hard to walk through. Any of you ever been in a place like that? Really, really cool. There's one of the neatest types of weapons. And they get their common name because they're like four species of at least three and maybe four that would occur. They get a big character for that. But they're not flood driven. They're groundwater discharge driven. They tend to stay wet for very long periods of time. They're really, really cool. Common impact is to either clear them or people have done their stormwater drains in them. So they're impacted a lot of cases by water. But that's what they look like. So that's the system we're working on. So we went out and we actually tried to find weapons in a variety of conditions, and this was our plant guy that was doing the work for us. He's out there exactly, I think we only have like 10 acre plot. And he's going to measure all the trees and all the ground cover vegetation. We're also, in many cases, interested in the amount of woody debris. This is also something that might be something that we have to wait for projects because woody debris is a very important part of the environment in a lot of, all forests and wetlands. And a lot of critters depend on woody debris. And due to your storage site, we're not going to have woody debris on the ground for 30 or 40 years. And we can do some things to accelerate that. So all of these things that are features of existing pretty high quality wetlands, we need to think of it, but we need to have our restoration sites consider those characteristics as well. We have a soil guy, this is the fellow that works with Pittsburgh. Take soil samples, measure the kind of organic matter, the color of the soil, the depth of the litter layer, pretty much the kind of soil stuff. This guy in the background is going to be really bored at the center tonight. You can see very much. You can tell these weapons, they aren't wet for much years. You can see roots growing right along the surface. That's a pretty good indication of the site they've wet for a long time. And indeed, the bayheads are wet. So this is a good example of a high-quality site. And we would also go to sites like this. Of course, just like here in Tennessee, but it's taken to a much greater extent. The coastal plain is an area where there's very intensive silvicultural activity. And many of those deep southern counties, this is right down the coast of Mississippi and Alabama, we work in three counties there. And the timber companies own huge blocks of land. Clear cuts that we see here of 100 acres or more by the several hundred to several thousand acres clear cuts there, but they'll actually cut up through the bayhead. This used to be a slope, or is still a slope weapon. And one of the points that I also try to make when I habitat class at depth for undergraduate students. A lot of people look at that and say, oh, that area is destroyed. Well, is it destroyed? No, it's not. Because nothing has been done to the underpinnings of that well. It's going to come back. They've not paved it over up here, so the water's going to infiltrate up here on this sand ridge. It's going to discharge down into this drain. The drain is still there. The only impact is best to divide it from you. But the weapon itself is not going to destroy it. And you know, a lot of people look at this and say, oh my God, we destroyed that weapon. Well, we haven't. We just We also looked at areas like this, and this is a perfect example of, now, I don't know if you've got this with primary law in effect, particularly for like the weapons here, but, you know, our primary law that we use for weapon protection is Section 404 of the Water Act, and basically we go out, which is another thing I've been involved with for years, taking folks out of their determination for the weapon boundary line. Well, we have regulations that either say you can't do it or certainly strongly inhibit people from selling weapons or otherwise prohibit destroying them. But there's nothing that says that you can't do whatever you want to, pretty much right up to the edge of the weapon. Now, we have a lot of others like this in Tennessee that are really good activity habitat. We see the same thing happening to them. So what do you think has happened to the amphibian habitat quality of this site? We haven't done anything to the weapon. We have not, failed an inch of it. We've done absolutely nothing to it. But its habitat quality, at least for some critters, has probably been reduced dramatically. So now, put together the information for the slope weapon, as I said, actually got into the amphibian literature. I didn't know all that much about it at the time. And I found that many amphibians actually spend the majority of the year in the adjacent upland forest. They get out of the wetlands to the upland forest. And so we have essentially eliminated the habitat that they use for most of their life. So I think that was a really good picture of how, yeah, we protected the wetlands, but yeah, we didn't really protect the wetlands very well. And so we went out and measured all of those things. That headwater flow system. And then the end product of all that is the guidebook is like the one that passed around, and the mathematical models that describe the relationship between all of those features that we measure, the size of the trees, the species composition, the landscape, etc. And they are consistently similar, as I mentioned, to the HSI model in HIP, the Habitat Suitability Index. So it's really nothing new, and what we're going to do is we're going to estimate the functional capacity of our target weapon. It can be any of those there that I showed you the picture. Our target weapon relative to the reference standard level. So in HGM, and this is what really the nice thing about HGM, relative to almost all the other weapon assessment methods that have been developed throughout the country, and there are dozens of them, and maybe hundreds of them. And the spring left side as well. TBA has their view of now called TBA RAM or something. And almost all of them, other than HGM, sort of ask you to go out and look questions. Is the tree community in good shape? Yes. Well, you ask the 12 or 15 out of the room or whatever, and you'll probably get 12 or 15 different answers. And particularly if you've got an environmental bias. Then, you know, but HGM. The nice thing about the HGM models is that they are actually based on reference data where we, the people all across the country, have gone out and measured characteristics of good, bad, and indifferent weapons and developed the models based on that rather than just asking the question of is the plant community in good shape or not. And so these models are much more objective. You're actually measuring things as opposed to providing some sort of judgment. We also consider the landscape surrounding the weapons, and this is a little bit different. We used to do assessments, the mindset of, okay, well, we're going to assess the weapon because we can't regulate anything outside the weapon, we're not going to consider that. But once we got into developing the model, and this is particularly true from a habitat standpoint, what goes on in the surrounding landscape may be as important or certainly nearly as important as what goes on with the weapon itself for a lot of critters. And so we realized that we've got to consider the ground and landscape. And a lot of the early assessment models, some of the newer stuff either. And so essentially our models are going to be based on all of these things. And these are just some examples of ones that you might see what type of weapon would be assessed Looking at that list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things, what get you sort of put a picture in mind, what kind of weapon are we working with there, what would it be?
driven system. It would probably be something like their overflow line in that part.
There's a subtle difference between flooding and ponding.
Pressing pond water
floods temporarily covers the lake surface, so it's just about the frequency of it. Ponding that will, you know, direct and this is what some of the, if you look through the guidebook and you look back at the model, you're going to see curves that look like this. And I've just got one example of this presentation, but this would be like something this would be out of the River Range guidebook that we worked on in Western Tennessee. We're looking at flood frequency. We went in and measured our reference standard weapons, and we found that the wolf, at least the upper wolf, the hatchie, some of the relatively unaltered weapons in Kentucky have return intervals or flood frequency. They can say over top of the facts at least every couple of years, and most of them actually over top of the facts more than once. And so the highest quality condition, the unaltered condition, is to have a very low number for return interval, and we give that a sub-index score of 1. So our reference standard weapon, which flood with a frequency that was supposed to, very often get the highest score. Once we get down for a weapon that doesn't flood, but every 5 years, we might not even have a weapon anymore. It may essentially be relegated to the condition I was describing a minute ago, where it's actually functioning like a carriage flat. It no longer functions like a regular weapon. And then, we generally don't want to zero these things out, because we want to consider the restoration potential of sites, and so we can up run curves to zero, and so they just generally will flatline out at like 0.1. So a weapon that floods only once every 5, you know, half a year will have one very, very logical. And then we'll take this, the score for this variable, and then integrate it for the number of other scores. Got a handout for those models. And they are aggregated into equations, and for example, this is what the function in most of the riverine guidebooks is called the temporary source of surface water, and the value for that would be the downstream doesn't flood, water fails, the floodplain sediment dropping out, it's providing recharge to the groundwater. So storing water is a valuable function. Down at the bottom, this is what that equation looks like. So we multiply the frequency of flooding, which is that graph I just showed you, with these other variables, this is the relative width of the floodplain. That variable tends to get that in my river system, if levied off or not, if the floodplain is channel ratio changes, that's an indication of levee in place. And then roughness is sort of the concept of some structure out of the floodplain can impede the flow of a water molecule downstream. So if we're all water molecules and we're moving across a forested floodplain, we're going to be continually bucking into stuff, and so our velocity is going to be lessened, and so sediment's going to drop out. It's good that it doesn't happen, and so the system working like it's supposed to. If I don't have any free community, then my roughness goes way, way down, and so that's a degraded system. And so the ag field, flood, don't have that surface roughness, and water will move across it faster. And then the slope of the weapon, this is not a variable that really ever changes. It was put in some of the early guidebooks in Western Kentucky because of a coal mining, strip mining, all heard of John Brown's line about Muhlenberg County. And I actually taught a weapon workshop up there a few years ago, and it's pretty good all the time. And so that impact, we don't ever we do see around Memphis, like around Calderville, the changing the flow of the floodplain is helping put it still. And so, what these variables are designed to do is pick up impact degradation. And they're just strung together in equations like this, and I've got, it's easier to explain than to swap the different changes that will come out there. So, there's probably nothing new here. I used this presentation in the course of 8 to 4, and there's training people in the hospital required to have a summary, they got to take it. It's real accepted, that's their only real function in life, is to be critical of what we do. And here's one of the places you can get on this website, is by most information that you want about Jeff, good guy, but sort of the repository for everything that deals with HGM that becomes a big bird lab. And so all of the public guidebooks are there, there's a lot of technical reports that have been produced, explaining veteran classification, veteran doctor. So that's a really good one.
These guys ever got on the website?
Oh, it used to be called the Waterway Experiment Station, that was what it was, and I was there, it's now called the DRDC, Environmental Research and Development Center. It's a bunch of the city here, and I did work, a lot of thousands, people work for them. Okay, so do we understand the HGM classification system? More or less?
Yes.
At least more or less?
More or less, and more by next Tuesday?
More or less, yes, sir.
These books you got passed around, and those, you know, they're about a specific one type, even in a certain area.
Yeah.
What's the coverage like?
Well, that's a good question, and here's another, this petty system has not been published, and have a bound copy of it, but it's for the freshman, flat level, and the Highland Rim. Even though it says for the Highland Rim, that's the only place we collect the data, I think that you can take the concepts in this guidebook and take it anywhere in the Mid-South, and the only thing that would really change is the plant communities, and so you might have to change the species composition a little bit. Most of these guidebooks really travel very well. We actually, the first guidebook that was published was the Kentucky guidebook, which I think was there. And we actually taught workshops and used it in South Carolina, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Washington State. That's the place that I worked with in Iowa. And we were just saying, you know, we go and we actually collect data when we were doing the workshop. We measure the size of the bridge and composition and actually look at everything and make sure it fits. But that's the beauty of HGM is that a headwater slope wetland in Washington State functions the very same as a headwater slope wetland in the peninsula of Florida. And so the guidebooks do travel very well. There's been reluctance on a lot of these parts to do that. And some of the people that are kind of driving the plane, I think, made some mistakes. More widespread use. And so what it ended up resulting was a lack of, you know, safety. We didn't have guidebooks, we didn't have any tools, yet all they had to do was really touch the safe next door and just change a few things that would work. Well, everybody get one of these? Okay. Well, the story of using HGM to do assessments has been a long and tortured one. And the reality that I think we face, and to my credit, I think I realized this long ago before one of my colleagues did, but if you give, like, you got something like this, and say, here, read this, and then we'll figure out how to do it, what are you going to do with it? You're going to put it over there on a pile, like an office is full of piles. I don't think that's my pile, but it's a pile. I think I'm a pile. Well, this stuff is a little pile, but I have to say, that's what happened with most of the guys. So after 10 years of working on all this, I and a few others realized that, we've gone to a lot of trouble, we've spent millions of dollars, literally millions of dollars, and nobody uses this thing. So what I did a few years ago was one of my graduate students, Mary Peterson, who developed the credit score, just like we did this, that's a loyal way that you actually have to develop and work. We decided that we would work with an Memphis district and take that guidebook there that was quite voluminous and distill it down to a filter. And so that's what I wanted for you guys to look at. And what I want you to do is take just a minute or two and look at the seven variables that are a part of this model.
Can I just say something back, you know, you might have, I don't know what you're gonna do with your project, but, you know, it was actually interesting to have, a person, keep working on the project, nobody yet. Nobody yet. Actually go into areas that are Randy side, 10-year-old side, 20-year-old side, and then, you know, ultimately, control side. And see what kind of stores are generated and, you know, actually see. And, you know, we all will freely admit that these models have not been adequately close validated. We don't know that the output that they produce is absolutely right up to thinking. You know, it certainly mirrors what we think as weapon professionals in various disciplines. You know, I don't know a lot about weapons out of defense, but people that do, they look at it and say, well, yeah, and they feel that we would work. You know, I'm sort of a habitat person, and I think, and so, you know, in fact, I've written all the habitat models for that. And so I tend to think that they certainly mirror what I think is appropriate. So, you know, what we need to do is, like, that guy took, like, the big green guy took, he made this wildlife community on the diversity. Diversity is everything in the forest, or it's mixed, or it's, free data. So we thought, well, okay, you know, that sort of captures the range of impact there. So we constructed the red ring guidebook around the birds. And to have diverse communities, so I can make that to our viewers, that you may need a block of 5 to 10,000 acres to have a truly high functioning bird community. So you've got a short population of change. When you go to different types of weapons, like we have around Cookville, we're dealing with small, mostly they were close. And so it's unrealistic to think I need, you know, 10,000 acres in every district in the first place. And so we focus the wildlife public road models on amphibians. And so for amphibians, you need a few hundred acres buffer, and that's it. So it's kind of different. But anyway, take a few minutes to look at this, and then we'll, I've got a little presentation to go through. And we can do then kind of whatever you want to do. We can actually, you know, go through and generate a score. I just, you know, I wanted you guys to get this and look at it. And maybe use it in the field. I want your field trip.
Now, where would the wildlife component add into this particular?
It's kind of, this is one mistake that I made in this. I guess I need to fix this. But function four, if you look over at page two, it's got the four functions, so we're going to generate four FCI scores, one for hydrologic storage, one for biochemical processes, retaining particulates, which is kind of a water quality function, and then four is maintaining characteristics not as community. And so what I did was kind of, well, that actually could be wildlife. There are three parts to that. There's plant community composition, and then variable seven is the landscape variable, and so the wildlife function is actually kind of subsumed there. And I did that because the Memphis District of the Corps wanted to combine the plant and animal communities, and there's most of the guidebook split out and get a score for how good the plant community, and then get a score for how good the wildlife community. And they didn't want to do that, and so
So based on your vegetation management that you have in here, categories and related scale are related to the wildlife community, whether it's the amphibian community or the bird community?
Well, in this case, it would be focused on the bird community.
Okay.
And the guidebook for the headwaters flats and depressions like you have in middle and east of the country would be focused on amphibian. Because it's a smaller scale. And we really don't have a lot of birds in this part of the world that are truly dependent on weapons, yet amphibians are, so that seems to just be a better fit for the smaller depressions like we have scattered around this part of the world.
Are there any biological assessment models or versions of HDM assessments that use more than one bird community for assessment?
Well, we did that in the, I don't know if I brought it, but the guidebook for the, that I made the presentation on the Headwaters Club guidebook, we did consider both the bourbon and the Indian community.
How did that work for you?
It was fine. And if we focus just on amphibians, really all you need for amphibians is show. And so even the graded weapons would probably provide good amphibian habitat as long as they had, you know, even exotic species of tree would provide show. There's a flock up there with the golden ogres that didn't want to desiccate the sun. But the bird community needs the right species composition and structure, and so for that, we use both options. You can kind of do whatever you can. What the models I've worked on, and there's like hundreds of these that have been developed all the way from Alaska to Florida, and I've only worked on like five or six. And, you know, other people have done things differently, and I guess I and the people that I work with believe we have done probably some of the better models that have been developed in the country. Some of the ones, there was a tendency early on to have more is better, so you've got some of the guidebooks have like 14 functions and dozens of variables. I reviewed one from Alaska that had 9 seal forms that had to be filled out. 9 pages of seal forms. It's like nobody ever used it. And so, you know, we thought we had to get it down to something like this.
Well,
every
get to the point where
Yeah, that's actually been talking with this very same issue with some folks late summer and this fall. It's possible that the Corps headquarters is going to actually mandate that assessment tools be used, and I think they're going to strongly recommend that they be objective. The problem that we face is that we did kind of miss the boat. We spent a lot of money, we produced really good models, but we made them so complicated that the typical person in the Corps offices weren't going to use them. You got an office here in North City, down the road. They're not going to use those big guidebooks. And so they had to do assessments, and so they turned to these things like PBA is working on now, where you don't really measure anything. You just sort of look at it and have this condition, and you know, it's not repeatable. You collected no data, but yet they look good. They're easy to do. People like them. They're packaged nicely. And so people have sort of picked up on those. And a lot of it came out of Ohio. So it's called O-RAM. And then there's another one in Florida. I forgot what it's called. But it's, you know, equally lame, and you don't really measure anything. You have no repeatability. And you could get, you know, disagreement at it just goes on a long time.
And then instead of compared to those at all?
No, and that's what we need to do. We really need to do. I taught a class just a few weeks ago out in Washington. And there were folks from Arkansas and from Indiana that were actually going to do that. They were going to take some of the similar field forms that I'd given them and, you know, kind of modify them from there, and they were going to compare them to the O-RAM lock stuff. You know, everybody looks at it and agrees. You know, they're totally subjective, they're not repeatable, and if you've got any kind of bias, you've not got to deal with it. So I think what we've done is really, really good, but it's like a lot of things in science. We did a good job of developing it, but we didn't do a good job of selling it. And so some of these other methods that really aren't nearly as good, and certainly are not as scientific, capture the stage. And, but I think, to get back to the original question, I think there's going to be a move by EPA and a lot of people have been forward to strongly recommend that some objective tool like HPM be used and required for weapons assessment. Agency people don't want to do it. They don't want any more work. And so the last thing that they want to hear is somebody tell them, now you've got to go out and do this, and, you know, in addition to what you've already been doing. That was the reason that I think that we really missed the boat, because I used to work, and I did a lot of work in the coast of Florida, and I met the people there in that office, and they would have as many as 120 permits on their desk at any one time. And that's all. I mean, they were constantly 2 years behind. It was like that long. you guys are going into an age when I was in your place. We had statisticians do the statistical analysis for us. How many of you run your own statistics now? Everybody. We have typists type our thesis or whatever. How many of you type your own thesis? We have moved into a society, and become a society, where particularly in our field, we're expected to do everything. I know the professors when I was in school here, they had plenty of spare time. They did a lot of hunting. And I don't know how much free time you've got, but I don't have as much as Dr. Dimmitt did when I was in school here. It's part of the nature of things. So we've got to make things somewhat simpler. At some point, we're just going to implode.
Have you all made, others made electronic versions of this? Just because, not so much, obviously it is a field component to yours, which is really nice and quantitative, but then there's also the crunching the numbers, which can be intimidating and even lend itself to mistakes for the field person out of field office going out there to do an assessment.
Yeah, there are spreadsheets that do that calculation.
But then you just plug the number in and it spits out the value of it.
I guess we could. And that was a shortcoming that we didn't have early on. And that was something that some of the folks have quit to rectify, so we do have to correct you. Well, I don't know what you want to do with this. I mean, you can look at this at some time later on. But basically, you know, when you get down to it, you're looking at the hydrology, you're looking at the plant community, and you're looking at the landscape. And those are the three fundamental parts of bottomland, hardwood, river, and wetlands. And so you're essentially asking the question, you know, is the condition of the wetland I'm assessing what it should be or not? It should be unaltered hydrology, but with the site floods every few years or so. And so the first two variables are getting at that. The next three variables we're getting at is my plant community, what it should be. I could have big trees, basically dominated by two cities down there in group one, the late successional, mostly oaks and two cities that you find in later serial stages of forest succession. And then the soil variable is really just getting at, you know, something fundamentally happened to the soil. Is it in land or mine or something? And then variable seven gets at, because block size is important in the big riverine system, do I have the big tract sizes that I need to have self-sustaining short populations of most of these species? And that seems to be the part of the assessments that the agency and a lot of people just intuitively have the most trouble with. And I talked with Dr. Bueller when I was working on this. And actually, I think probably had a small contract with him to review some of it. But people are bothered if you go out and they've got a 100-acre block of pretty nice woods and they look up there and say 100 acres is for the 0.3. And they're bothered by that. And I certainly am bothered by that too. But in terms of is it what it should be, the answer is no. It's not providing as good a habitat as it should. And I think we just need to recognize that. And a lot of the agencies just it's really almost come under the loop. You know, there'd be a 40-acre block near Memphis, and they say, this is the best wetland that we've got. And I say, well, guys, I understand that. But, you know, relative to what it should be, it's not providing the habitat quality that it should. But, you know, having said all that, I did try to, you know, if you read and look at the equation, I did make variable 7 have less weight than the others. And so, if it's a good block of wood, but it's a small fragment, it's still going to score relatively high. So I tried to deal with all of that. Well, would you prefer just kind of just leave it with them and they can look at it at their leisure? And I know if I were you, I wouldn't go out anywhere tonight. I never did when I was in school, and I'd go home and read this stuff. Like all the places I used to go were
got. Good information, y'all. So we've kind of
talk about two things today. One was HGM classification as a beginning, and then actually using aspects of HGM classification to assess the quality of the well. And I saw that you had some slides on biotic assessment.
Well, it all it did was essentially explain the logic for that last function, which I think that I did.
I did have one question for one of the students that isn't here. And so you can elect it, respond or not respond. The question was, what were your feelings about the black swamp issue controversy that kind of erupted? And everybody in here is going to be reading about the black swamp controversy. Jim Johnson, Cook, and Ross will probably be visiting.
Well, black swamp